Action.
Okay. I am here with Stu Phillips right now, and Stu has agreed to do a podcast with me. Now, I always have Brad Schoenfeld on my podcast as kind of... Brad and I connected a few years back, and he's been my main go-to guy for discussions with hypertrophy. But there's always been another guy out there by the name of Stu Phillips who publishes... Stu, what university are you at? McMaster's University?
Yeah, I'm at McMaster University, which is in Hamilton, Ontario, so that's about 30 miles outside of Toronto, but I'm actually coming to you from, I'm in the UK right now, so I'm on a research leave, so I'm at Loughborough University, just outside of Nottingham. So I think we're 8 hours or 7 hours different, I don't know.
Yeah, so, but Stu does a ton of research in the fields of sports nutrition and hypertrophy, and kind of what do you mostly look at, Stu?
Really, it's the interaction between exercise, mostly resistance exercise, and protein ingestion, and the effects that that has on the fluctuation in muscle protein turnover, mostly the synthesis of new muscle proteins, and then sometimes if we see something promising, we'll take it out in a full-blown training study, and we'll look at it on the outcome of hypertrophy.
So this brings me to my next point. You have a few big contributions to our industry, and one of the main ones has been, at some point you started to doubt this hormone myth, and this was a lot of research done by, I would say, Kramer would be the main one. Kramer and a lot of his colleagues, and for probably at least 10 years, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe even longer, everyone in the field, it was accepted as gospel that if you want to get muscular, you need to be doing these big compound lifts, which isn't to say we shouldn't do these big compound lifts, but our explanation was that you're going to do a set of squats or a set of deadlifts or some big compound exercise, and it's going to cause you to release a lot of testosterone and growth hormone, and this is going to travel through your bloodstream, and it's going to make you more muscular everywhere because this testosterone coursing through your blood, it's going to, you know, attach to the receptor sites of all of your muscles, and you will notice increased growth on your shoulders, your arms, your entire body because of the squats. And again, this isn't to say you shouldn't be doing your squats and your deadlifts. It's just to say that our understanding of the mechanisms were wrong. And so, Stu, you've done a lot of research in this area, and you initially, there was a lot of resistance coming your way. Like anything, if you're the myth buster, you're the enemy. And so talk to me about this line of research.
Yeah, well, you know, I think you've nicely summarized there what we would tend to refer to in my lab as the hormone hypothesis, and you get this we call it relatively short-lived because for the most part it's up and down inside of 15 to 30 minutes rise in things like testosterone, growth hormone, and insulin-like growth factor, to name what I think are the most common ones. And so most people look at that, and those hormones, when they're chronically elevated, so if you have a high level of testosterone, for example, from taking, you know, exogenous anabolic steroids, or you have low levels of testosterone because of hypogonadism as a condition from maybe taking drugs if you've been treated for prostate cancer, for example, it's associated with higher and lower muscle mass. And so it's intrinsically appealing to say that those hormones should have an effect. The main problem is with that hypothesis is that it's never really been interrogated. It was just look, these hormones go up, they're present in high concentrations, but it's a very, very short period of time. And when you look and measure their concentrations, they're really not elevated that much above what we usually fluctuate up and down throughout a day. So we don't think that they're tremendously elevated per se. They're just really on the sort of high end of normal for 15 minutes, and it's really hard to ascribe a function to a hormone like that in such a short period of time. So we've conducted a series of studies where we tried to sort of push through manipulating models and to see whether we could pick up an effect of that first on stimulating protein synthesis and then subsequently on stimulating hypertrophy. And, you know, we're up at around, I think, 6 or 7 different studies right now where we've been unable to see an association between the rise in testosterone or growth hormone or insulin-like growth factor and stimulation of protein synthesis or hypertrophy. And so, you know, we've sort of looked for this mechanism that's been thought to be there, and we've just found no evidence of it. So, you know, I mean, absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence, but you know, the correlative argument is the one that was put forward before, and we haven't seen any association with, now we've had, I think, over about 100 individuals where we've looked at this relationship, and we've just been unable to find it. So I'd 100% agree with what you're saying about these big compound lifts, very useful, great hypertrophy, you know, great in terms of enhancing strength, and of course you should be doing them. But the mechanism for how they work is probably more local within the muscle than it is to do with the hormones per se.
So let me kind of summarize here. You have done acute studies looking at increased muscle protein synthesis immediately following the workout. You will always see that hormones are indeed elevated, and you will see muscle protein synthesis elevated for the muscle that was trained. But the muscle that was not trained, you will not see increases in muscle protein synthesis, even though hormones are higher.
Exactly.
And you've also done training studies long-term to see if, you know, 8 weeks of training or whatever is going to increase muscle protein or increase hypertrophy for the muscle that's not being trained. And you will not see that.
Exactly.
And so it mostly comes down to, yes, these compound lifts work, or the exercise works because it's building hypertrophy in the muscle that it's highly activating, but not the muscle that's not being activated.
Yeah, exactly. So there's no crossover to a muscle that is, you know, being bathed in these hormones where it's supposed to work. There's no hypertrophy in sites that are, you know, distant from the ones being exercised. And similarly, when we enhance the exposure of even an exercise muscle, so we get somebody to do some arm curls and then we follow it with a big leg workout, or even vice versa, it doesn't really matter. So you would think that the arm should just, you know, it should grow much bigger than the other arm if you're just exercising it alone, but we don't see any effect there. And it's hard to budge people away from sort of, you know, that central dogmatic thinking. And all we're trying to do, of course, with this is to say, well, you know, if there is a mechanism, it's pretty subtle. It doesn't really have a huge effect. And we think more of that hypertrophy is due to things that are happening locally within the muscle. So we know, for example, that things like muscle satellite cells, which are these important cells that contribute nuclei to growing muscle fibers, are maybe enhanced by these hormones, or something even produced within the muscle locally is important. But we don't think that these circulating systemic, you know, in the bloodstream hormones are that important.
And so my takeaway with this is, has always been, don't rely, like, we got to a point, I remember back in the day, Stu, I don't know if you ever followed, but I can think back to these articles from, this was probably 13, 14 years ago. I used to read, I was always an avid researcher, and I used to read these websites like Cyberpump and HIIT or Hard Gainer, and it would always tell you to just stick to a few exercises, and kind of the high intensity training philosophy was just do, and I think the workouts would be like a set of squats or trap bar deadlifts, and then if you pick the squats, you would followed up with a set of straight leg deadlifts, and then maybe a set of bench, a set of bent over rows, and you're done. Or maybe a set of weighted dips or weighted chins, and you're done. And, you know, sometimes people would tweak it and add in their own things, but The premise was you would get muscular all over from getting stronger at these lifts. And while I learned from everything. So with HIIT, I learned progressive overload is the most important. The first set is the most important. But if you want your traps to grow, or if you want your delts to grow, or if you want a certain muscle to grow, you should probably be doing some isolation movement for it, rather than just thinking that your squats are deadlifts. Now, that's not to say you won't get big triceps from bench press, because the triceps are highly activated, but I always think of bodybuilding and physique training, like think of the muscle that you want to get to grow and make sure you're highly activating it. Is that your consensus as well?
100%. Yeah. I mean, it's not going to grow if it's not, you know, you're not activating or hitting the fibers. You can have a little bit of a hormonal rush, but just remember that, you know, these hormones last, the spike comes up, it's high at 15. It's maybe a little bit higher, coming down by 30, 60 minutes after the workout, it's gone. And that's a situation that's remarkably different from an argument that continually gets put forward, which is, well, steroids work. And I'm like, yes, of course they work, but that's elevation of testosterone to 5 times normal 24/7 for however long you take the steroids. And that's a very different situation from that very transient and relatively speaking low elevation in these hormones that you see after exercise. But you're 100% on the money. You've got to activate the muscle to make it grow. And so that indicates that it has to be something that's fairly local to the muscle that's really driving the whole stimulus. If hormones have a role, it's pretty small, we think.
You bring up a very good point. You know, I was completely naive to a lot of the bodybuilding and powerlifting worlds and how much anabolic steroids they were actually taking. And I started finding out some of the cycles they were on, and it's like you do the math and they're taking, you know, upwards of 2,000, some people even like 4,000 milligrams a week of stuff. And the average human male makes like, you know, 7 milligrams a day of testosterone. And so if we're making between, I don't know, 70 and like 100 milligrams a week of testosterone, and someone's injecting themselves with 2,000 milligrams of different substances per week, then that's 20 times over what, you know, what the average male is making. Of course that works. It's going to make you a lot more muscular, because round the clock you're having this extremely highly elevated anabolic milieu going on in your system. But you can't compare that to doing a high-intensity workout where afterwards your levels are going to be, what are they doubled? Are they tripled? I don't really know. But
yeah, for the most part, they go up 2 to 3 times what they are at rest or before the workout, and they stay that way for usually about half an hour, sometimes a little longer. And then what you see afterwards is actually they tend to come down a little bit lower, and it's just, I mean, that's the way hormones work. Yep. And what you have to remember is our hormones fluctuate like this throughout a day. When you're, you know, taking steroids, they're up here and they stay up here.
Yep.
And that's just, you know, that's not what we do biologically, right?
So the kind of like the area under the curve or whatever wouldn't be that affected throughout the course of 24 hours, because you'd get the 30-minute spike and then they dip down and then they climb back to normal. Or they might be elevated. They might stay slightly elevated. But if you look at, another important factor is anabolic and catabolic hormones will be elevated. So you'll have growth hormone, IGF-1, and testosterone that are elevated. You'll have cortisol and maybe some other things that are elevated. And so its net effect on muscle protein synthesis, again, the muscle being activated will grow, but the muscles not being activated, the effect on them is going to be minimal. So make sure you're working the muscles that you want to grow. Now, I always, it's funny because you read other people's research and then, you know, we all read a lot of different research, and I've always been curious about some other areas, like the effect of, I have come across research showing that testosterone increases strength through increased calcium release out of the sarcolemma or something like this. So I always thought that it would be good to kind of keep good for strength. to keep testosterone elevated if you can, or to try out strategies. And I have tried over the course of my training career, like daily training with squats and things like that, which I used to be a fan of, but I just think people, that certain Olympic weightlifting coaches would recommend this. And some people see really good results from it, but I've kind of shifted away from that because I think you can do squats 3 times a week and see great results. But I was always curious about why some people see such great results with this such high frequency, because in theory, you need to repair. You need to, you know, you stimulate the muscle and then you need to rest and recuperate and let it grow. But I have some colleagues that when they started doing the high frequency squatting, their strength went through the roof. I don't think you can keep that up indefinitely, but I do think a lot of lifters have like a few month window where they can try out this new stimulus, this high frequency stimulus, and see good results from it. And I always wondered if it was due to I don't know why it is. It's due to the skill component, or is it there's something to do with hormones or something? Because they would say the soreness kind of goes away. They don't feel as stiff. And I don't know why this. I don't know why this is.
Yeah, we don't know either. But we've done enough training studies now, and I've looked at guys who were trained and guys who were untrained to sort of, you know, in my mind, I think there's a continuum of sort of the ability to adapt, and people who are lifetime lifters have sort of figured out that they have some propensity to be strong or to be muscular. They enjoy the activity. And they've clearly probably got some genetic predisposition towards either getting stronger, gaining muscle mass, a combination of the both. And in doing so then, they probably got an enhanced repair and regeneration capacity. So they're able to withstand volumes of exercise that, you know, most mere mortals would pale at. So, you know, what they have that the rest of us don't, is hard to say right now. But what we do see in all of these training studies, and I know it sort of irritates some people because they think there's something that, you know, we're not switching on, is we see a variation in a response that's pretty substantial. So we see people that are, you know, big responders in terms of strength and hypertrophy. We see people that are, they just, and it's not for lack of work, they just don't tend to get as strong. They find it harder to train, and they don't gain as much muscle. You could argue that, you know, there's various things you can tweak with that person to get them to respond. And my answer is probably yes, but I don't think if you're in the bottom 20% of non-responders that you're ever going to leap from there to the top 20%. We could maybe move you into the next 20th percentile, but I think you're always going to be sort of down that end, and you know that has to be something genetic in my mind, and the question as to what it is pretty hard to determine, to be honest with you.
Yeah, this is a good line of research by certain researchers out there that are looking at this stuff. I remember a few years back I wrote an article for T-Nation called "The Truth About Bodybuilding Genetics." And some of the it's something we don't like to talk about because we're trying to encourage people to exercise and lift weights and talking about the benefits of lifting weights, and we're trying to tell everyone you can radically transform your physique. And some of these studies, they looked at a lot of subjects, and they coined some of them non-responders, and I can't remember the exact details, but a large percentage, I don't know if it was 20%, but did not see much results at all. And they took people through, I think it was an arm routine, like biceps and triceps exercise twice a week for like 12 weeks. I mean, you would think you would grow from that. You should see, if you're untrained and you start doing twice a week of arm training, your arms should grow. And I think the difference between the top responders double their strength and increase their hypertrophy by like, you know, 50 to 70% or something like that. And then the non-responders gain no strength and no muscle mass at all. And so then they did a follow-up study to this and took biopsies of the top responders and the non-responders. And they saw all sorts of things that were different. They saw that the satellite cells that you talked about earlier, that satellite cell mechanism was impaired with the non-responders, in that not only were they not getting the satellite cells to donate their nuclei, but they also weren't replenishing, whereas the best responders would donate their satellite cells, and then they'd go in and look at the satellite pool, and it would be higher than it was before. So they'd have this super compensated satellite cell pool. And then I think a lot of the IGF-1 and different growth factors were way lower in the non-responders. And so some people's physiology is just built to respond and to grow, and other people just don't have that.
Yeah. And it shouldn't be maybe as big a shock to people as you would think. I mean, muscular growth and hypertrophy is a fairly complex physiological process, and I think we're learning more and more each day that, you know, the underpinnings of a lot of chronic diseases and a lot of things have a genetic component to them. And so why would it surprise anybody that muscular growth has a genetic component to it? I'm not saying it's entirely governed by genetics, but, you know, if this is the mean and everybody dovetails out, then there's always going to be these sort of special individuals out here. And, you know, these guys have obviously figured something out early in life. They lifted a few weights. And, you know, you've seen these guys, I'm sure, is that, you know, they just seem to grow in front of your eyes. And, you know, we've done enough training studies now where we sort of seen about 7 or 8 of those individuals in about 100. And so it's, you know, that's the 1.5%, 2.5%, the small tail there. And these guys put on phenomenal amounts of muscle. They get way stronger. And, you know, it's a revelation to them sometimes, because none of them are, you know, particularly active before that, but they just have something that makes them special. And then you say, you know, what does your dad look like? What do your brothers look like? And they're all bigger guys, you know. And they, so, you know, I'm beginning to believe it more and more. I think we're going to see in the next few years some research that will begin to delineate some of that.
Well, what's interesting, a couple side notes from this line of discussion is that, one, this is why it's important to do studies with ample subjects, because there's so much variation. Why anecdotes aren't always, you know, you can't always rely on anecdotes. Like, this got me completely jacked, you should do it. Well, you might be a good responder. And second of all, our industry... So many of the people in our industry like to look at the biggest guy and go to him for advice and follow his routine. And a lot of times that guy's just the luckiest in terms of genetics.
Sure.
Okay, moving on. There was a paper that your lab published by Mitchell. I can't remember I didn't write down the title of the paper, but something about heavier weights. So another area of research that your lab has, and by the way, Stu, I'm a fellow guy who likes to kind of bust myths and misconceptions, and I want to say I have a lot of respect for you, because it's draining. It is so draining, to the point, Stu, where sometimes, you know, I have some things that I've kind of discovered in my lab. I have EMG and force plate, and, you know, I don't have like a full on like a lab like a university would, but I have a couple things that I've found, and I'm just something I found a year ago, and I'm like, I'm gonna wait for it to be published, because I don't want to be accused of, I don't have the energy right now to battle all the powerlifters who are gonna tell me that I'm an idiot and all this stuff. And sometimes you know that this is going to weigh me down. I'm going to be accused. I'm going to be, you know, mocked. And you have to fight through it. And you have to read on the social media. This, you know, the people who don't understand the research are going to accuse you of being an idiot. And you're going to have to, have to explain these things to these types ad nauseum, because they just don't understand. You know, they're hell-bent. They don't want to change their opinion on something. And so when you have guys like you who are out there busting myths and misconceptions in the name of science, I commend you guys, because it's so much easier to just not do any research and be that guy who's, this guy's telling us not to do squats and deadlifts. Apparently he doesn't think, you know, and it's like, no, that's not what we're saying. That's not the point. This guy's saying not to lift heavy weights. No, you're not saying that. You're just saying you can get the same growth through lighter weights. And so that's another area of research that your lab has come out with over the last several years. And we're heading more and more in this direction. your lab has lots of studies now, probably, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe like 6 or 7, where showing that lighter loads taken close to failure can induce just as much hypertrophy as heavier weights. And kind of as long as effort is there, if the effort is there and you're working hard, then you can kind of choose the load that makes you, that if you're a type of lifter that does not like heavy loads, you don't have to do heavy loads. If you're just a physique person, if you're just training for hypertrophy, you can train in the 10, just with 10 rep maxes or even 20 rep maxes, possibly even 30 rep maxes, and see similar growth as you could as if you were doing heavy weights. Talk about this, and then don't let me forget, because I want to talk about the Mitchell paper with the type 1 and 2 fiber growth, but talk right about this topic for a minute.
Right. So first of all, thanks for the comments about being a myth, but I don't think we set out to bust myths, but we certainly like to challenge dogma, and you know, this was one of the things that we looked at. We looked at certain statements from certain organizations saying is that, and it wasn't that, you know, you can only get hypertrophy from lifting heavy, but it said that lifting heavier was superior to lifting lighter. And they name a few sort of percentage of repetitions that I just said, you know, there's really not enough evidence to say that. I don't think that that's the case. And so we sort of went back to basic physiology and said, if you take a muscle to fatigue, it really doesn't, the muscle doesn't understand how it really got to fatigue. Fatigue is fatigue. And according to something called the size principle, then fatigue means is your muscle is trying to sustain a given level of force. And it will do that by recruiting certain motor units. So traditionally type 2 or the fast twitch or type 1 motor units. And so if you get there through lifting heavy loads, we know that you sort of get to a certain rep and then bang, you can't generate the force. If you get there through a lighter load, it's sort of different. At the end of the rep, you're kind of doing this sort of thing and your muscle's kind of shaking, but it's still fatigue. And if the size principle, which is, you know, sort of very central tenet of muscle metabolism and muscle physiology is correct, then you should have activated or be close to anyway, full activation of muscle fibers. And if that's the case, then our thought was that the load and how you got there mattered less than actually getting there. So lighter loads, heavier loads, and we certainly didn't get into this wanting to rewrite the strength and conditioning manuals. You know, I've said to a lot of people, if you want to get stronger, you have to lift heavy weights. So, that, you know, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. That's very yep. clear.
So this is not about strength. If you want, no. If your strength is your goal, you've got to be going heavier. But if you're just, I would say the majority of people, when they start training with you, they don't care about strength. They want a good physique. Right. They don't come to you and say, I just want to be strong and I have powerlifting goals in mind. They say, just help me get a better physique.
Sure. So it's about hypertrophy. It's about muscular growth and changing muscle size and then, as you say, improving your physique. So, you know, we did some experiments where at first we measured protein synthesis, which a lot of people quite correctly point out. They go, well, that's not hypertrophy. And I'm like, you're 100% correct, but we needed the proof of the principle first. And so we noticed that the protein synthetic response was as good with the low lows to fatigue as it was with the high lows to fatigue. And so we said, well, look, you know, this is at least, you know, a pretty good grounding to move on to a training study. So in the Mitchell study, what we did was, you know, we randomized people. And again, you know, it's a contrived design. We try and do studies where we minimize variability. So, you know, my one leg versus my other leg is always less variability within me than between me and between you, for example. A lot of people don't like the design. I get it. But so the main point was this load, you know, this leg trains with heavy load, this leg trains with light load, and the hypertrophy is the same at the end of, you know, 10, 12, whatever, however many weeks. This leg gets stronger than this leg, which is exactly what you'd expect. But, you know, the proof of the principle that heavier loads are superior to lighter loads is just not there. So, and I think in fairness to the, particularly the bodybuilders and the physique people, they understand this, that they do, they don't tend to lift, they can't lift heavy all the time because of the volume that they do. So they cycle on and off. And what they notice is that their strength might go down. But I think if they take things to fatigue, there's really not a lot of change in their muscle mass or their physique. That stays pretty much intact. And so, you know, even at its, you know, sort of scientific best, I think in the gym, people have figured this stuff out. But so what it meant to us is that the recommendations for generation of muscular hypertrophy weren't exactly correct. And I know, since you've probably had Brad on your show a number of times, is that, you know, he and I have discussed this over email, and, you know, he's argued that, well, you know, we know from studies, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't know whether he shared it with you, but he's got some research that actually, I think, tends to fit with what we're showing as well. And so,
well, I will, because I'm
maybe coming over to our side.
Yeah. And God, I have all these tangents I want to talk about. So I'm gonna touch on this in a second. But a couple things that I was trying to mentally keep in mind while I was listening to you. First of all, you still see these charts with these telling you what, and it's like 1 to 10 reps will do, or 1 to 5 reps will do this for you. 5 to 10 will do this, and it's not that. That's not that way.
No.
Now back to the size principle. I first started hearing about the size principle from Carpinelli, who obviously got it from other people, but he's kind of the person who first started saying this.
Yep.
Take a set to failure, and you're going to activate the muscles to the same degree, whether you're using a heavyweight or a lightweight.
Yep.
And this activation, a lot of people nowadays kind of think activation isn't all that, and I'm like, so what, you can just, how's the muscle going to grow then if it's not activating?
Right.
If you want a muscle to grow, you got to, and now we could argue what, you know, what are the optimal protocols, but you got to be choosing an exercise that does highly activate that region. Now, I was very doubtful of this, and I wanted to tell you this because you changed my mind, and this is what researchers should do. Because I had done a ton of EMG research, but I had never, every one of my protocols, I like doing case studies. I like taking someone and having them hooked up to the electrodes for 3 straight hours where we do a ton of stuff. I can't have them go into failure on all their sets or they'd fizzle out. Right. So we'll take a 5-rep max load and I'll have them do 2 or 3 reps. That's important because they're not getting fatigued. So I can test them, and it depends on the exercise. If it's something that's a more of a high rep movement, I might have them do 8 reps, but they could do 20 to 30. But I do this because I'm sparing fatigue so they can do, so I can test them on 20 to 30 different exercises.
Right.
But I never had them go to failure. And so when I started seeing your research, so I always was the opinion that heavy weights are better, because when you take heavier weights, you start off high right off the bat.
Sure.
And then I started taking lighter loads and going to failure. Now, I will say it does depend on the exercise. You don't always, and there is a sweet spot in my opinion where you can't just take, you know, I can't just do body weight arm curls.
Right.
You know,
right.
There's some
100%.
Right. There's some point where, and Brad and I don't know if Brad told you this, we're trying to publish a paper right now with leg press.
Right.
We looked at 30% versus 75, I believe.
Right.
And the 30% did not reach the 75. But that doesn't mean, what it means is that, but there's going to be some sweet spot somewhere. And it might depend on the exercise. It might depend on the muscle group. But I will tell you, with glutes, I had done body weight stuff. When you do body weight squats or body weight glute bridges, the muscle activation doesn't keep going up. It kind of, it's like it's aerobic or something, because it stays put. So I was always doubtful of this stuff. And I was like, no way, heavier weights are better. But then I started doing, you know, a set of 20 to failure, a real set of 20 to absolute failure, set of 20, whatever. I'd get 22 reps, and lo and behold, say I did squats or hip thrusts or deadlifts, it doesn't matter. Whatever I would get with, like, say, a 5-rep max load, I would end up getting with a 20, whatever failure ended up being, say 22 reps.
Yeah.
Those peaks would end up matching the peaks that I got with the 5-rep set.
Right.
And what I found was when I would start off with something, say I was getting, you know, peaks of 80 right off the bat with like a hip thrust, I would end up on my 22nd rep getting a peak of 160. It would double throughout the set. And I would end up getting the same as what I did with the heavier loads. And so I realized that's really cool, because the practical applications of this is that, you know, the elderly or in rehab situations, you don't want to be loading them up heavy right away, or you don't want necessarily want to go there. Have them do the lighter weights for higher reps while keeping form really good. There's going to be a lower chance of injuring themselves.
Right.
So they get the hypertrophy they can get. Now, back to the Mitchell paper. Oh, so anyway, this is what researchers should do. I'm skeptical of what you're saying, but I'm going to go experiment on my own. Oh, he's right, you know.
Yeah.
We should use more of that instead of, oh, you're an idiot, but then I'll never test out what you're saying, which is what I see often in the field. The critical people will never change their mind. They'll never go do the research on their own. They'll never go do any experiments. They'll just continue to criticize and go, oh, what does the researcher know? And by the way, Stu, you lift weights yourselves. You're a strong guy. Yeah.
I'm the complete middle of the road guy. I'm not the big guy. I don't think I'm the little guy, but I'm about as average as they can. Everybody hates to be average, but I mean I'm not super strong and I'm not super big, but I'm not small and I'm not weak either. So.
But the researchers are always painted out to be these lab coats that don't, you know, do you even lift? And it's not that's in my experience, because I've met a lot of the sports science researchers around the world at this point, and most of them were old coaches and lifters themselves, and that's what drew them into the field. It's not like they're these esoteric, you know, nerds that have never lifted a weight.
I didn't get into this because, you know, I mean, I enjoy being in a lab and I enjoy science, but yeah, you know, I played rugby, I played ice hockey, I played, you know, football, and most of the lifting I did was for, you know, sports to get bigger and stronger, faster and everything. You know, I have to admit to never having, you know, lifted to improve my physique per se, but, you know, yeah, I've got some genetic predisposition. You know, I tend to look like that rather than to be like this. And so, you know, but I'm not that big.
But the point is, we're not these esoteric nerds that don't lift. We work out, and there is value. Like, the recommendations get twisted sometimes. You're not saying, like in the hormonal stuff, you're not saying don't do squats and deadlifts. You're saying it gets twisted into that. You're saying do exercises for that body part for which you want to grow. With the high rep stuff, you're not saying don't ever do low reps. You're saying that you can get good growth out of doing lower weight for higher reps.
100%. And I think a lot of this is driven by, and you mentioned a couple of situations for older people and rehabilitation, but also, you know, from my own personal perspective, the older I get, all that I find now is, you know, I squat, I deadlift, I mean, I do all the compound stuff, but it's harder to recover. And, you know, so to me now, it's a lifetime game. And I'm looking at, you know, doing this until I'm into my, you know, 70s, 80s or whenever. And so, you know, part of it was driven by how can you still maintain this and yet allow more recovery? Because if I think if there's anything that happens with aging, it's the ability to recover is you know, a bit messed up for whatever reason. So, you know, part of it was driven by that. And, again, personal experimentation, you just sort of say, well, I'm going to drop things down. Jeez, you know, I don't want to do that because, you know, lifting heavy is the way to go. And you find, actually, yeah, okay, my strength went down, but muscle mass-wise, nothing changed. And I was like, you know, there's something to this. So, you know, you figure a lot of this stuff out yourself, and then you do some reading. Yep. And then when that statement gets made that lifting heavy is superior, you know, you begin to think about the physiology, and you're like, you know, that doesn't make sense, actually, if you think about it. But what I agree with you is that 30% for a leg press is not going to do it, because you could probably do 70 or 80 repetitions for some people. So maybe you've got to choose something like 50 versus, you know, 80. Eventually at 50, after your 33rd rep, you know, your legs are shaking like a sewing machine. It hurts. I'll agree.
Yep.
But it's still fatigue.
And that brings me to good
fiber activation.
I don't want to forget this, because this is an important point, because Brad is doing research right now with 30 reps or a certain percentage. I can't remember, but it is very, I mean, I've read studies back in the day, where these people had to drop out because they get so much nausea. You know, it's not like whoever thinks that 20 reps is for wimps. We're not talking about just holding on to pink dumbbells going like this. We're talking about taking something to failure. I would rather do a set of 5 than a set of 20 to failure. I remember back in the day being able to do squat 225 pounds for like 25 reps, and I could deadlift 315 for 25 reps, and it was the worst thing. You want mentally, oh my God, it is not easy. So what I like to do is stick to my, in my own training, and it's funny you mentioned, because I was listening to what's his face? Steve Jobs audiobook, and he was talking about a lot of his innovation drove from things that he wanted for himself. They would create the products that they wanted, you know, the iPod they wanted one themselves. And it's funny because in our field, we're going to be driven towards research. You know, I want to benefit my own training. So I want to see if my, you know, you form a hypothesis. I wonder if, my strength will drop out, but I wonder if I can keep my hypertrophy from just sticking to just lighter weight. And then you do it, you test the hypothesis, you see, and then you go, okay, let's test this with a larger group of people.
Right.
And so a lot of our own research gets driven from things that interest us. That's natural. But for the people who think that lighter loads is wimpy, man, they're clearly not going to failure with lighter loads, because it is not wimpy. There's nothing wimpy about it. It is hard to do.
It hurts.
Yeah.
It hurts. And if you haven't done it, and you know, try it yourself, and you're in for a rude awakening, I'll tell you.
Right. You're in for a rude awakening once you actually start going to failure with lighter loads. So this is just to say that, this isn't to say don't do heavy weights. It's just to say lighter loads taken close to muscular failure is a very potent hypertrophic stimulus. Now, back to the Mitchell paper.
Yep.
So the size principle states that if you take, say you do a 1 rep max to failure, you're going to recruit all the available motor units because you are doing a maximal effort. But if you take a lighter load, like we said, you start out and it keeps increasing each rep until when you go to absolute failure, to counteract fatigue, the muscles get activated higher to try to match the force production, and you will end up getting as high as that maximal effort at the point of failure. But it goes backwards. With that heavy load, you're supposed to recruit all the units, including all the type 1 units. And this might not be the case, or maybe they need more time under tension, which they get with the lighter loads, because what we're seeing with the Mitchell paper is that you will get doing heavy weight, doing lighter weight, you get similar amounts of muscle hypertrophy, but the heavier weight and the lighter weight, they're similar in terms of type 2 muscle fiber growth, but the lighter weight's better in terms of type 1 muscle growth.
Yeah, and that's a point that Brad and I have discussed, and you know, Brad is fond of the theory, and it makes a lot of sense, and as the, you know, when you said it right there, is that when you cycle through those type 1 units and you know towards the fatigue that you get, then you do engage those fibers probably more than when you're engaging them, you know, down at the lower repetitions. And maybe that's a protective mechanism to just, you know, hold some of those fibers and motor units in reserve. You know, the third set and then the fourth set, I'm sure they're coming into play. But you're right. It seems to be is that the type ones tend to grow a little bit more. The Mitchell paper, we just didn't have the statistical power to show anything significant. So the goal is, you know, we have a study underway to try and see whether that's the case. And so the biopsy data from enough men will show us whether that's the case. And so I know in concert with some of the work that Brad's doing, hopefully we can crack this nut and sort of say, you know, this is why it's happening. Here's where it's happening and the reason behind it. But again, so if you want to maximize hypertrophy, then what you're talking about is really trying to do both forms of training. So maybe some high intensity and some low intensity to engage all of the fibers.
Yep.
And to mix things up program wise to hit the type ones and the type twos.
So that's what I would like to see over time is, and this is with so much areas of research. Brad and I talk about this all the time. We would like to see, okay, people will say this exercise versus this exercise, but what about if you do them both? People will say this rep range versus this rep range. What if you do them both?
Yeah.
And so, personally, I think if you're looking at a way to maximize hypertrophy, a lot of the bodybuilders would pyramid. They do a variety of, they'd never stick to one load. They would do a variety. And so for optimal, maybe it's that you need to do a certain amount of, get a certain amount of volume in at the lower end and a certain amount at the higher end. And then you're covering all your bases. Whether that's the case remains to be seen.
Right.
Some of the critics of your research will look at what you mentioned, this crossover design, where you take one leg and do high reps with it, the other leg and do low reps with it. And I think the two main criticisms are that you don't have that design, you can have the crossover effect. So some researchers shows that if you do one leg, just one leg, the other leg will get stronger and will get more muscular due to the crossover effect because you got in your brain the cortex or whatever that crosses over and you end up getting, but your research shows that that's not so substantial where it's going to completely skew the results. Maybe that's responsible for a couple percent, but.
Right. And I think, Simon Gandavia, who's in Australia, has written sort of the authoritative review on this, and he's even got it down to the sort of percentage crossover that you would see in terms of the strength enhancement. Now, the mechanism would be is that the stronger leg would always pull up the weaker leg a little bit, but it can account for all the variation. And what you have to remember, and I sort of just explain this to my students when I teach the undergraduate classes, is to say is that, research is like building a house. And so we have to build a foundation first, and then we put some things into place, and then we begin to, and you try and build a whole story. Sometimes you can build a house with one paper, it generally ends up in Nature or Science or, New England Journal of Medicine.
Right.
But in physiology, that's not going to happen. And so we have to build some things along the way. So, first we did the protein synthesis, and then we did a, unilateral proof of principle trial. So the next step is to do the between subjects, one group trains like this, one group trains like this, but appreciating that as you go up in the ladder with those experimental designs, the variability gets higher. And so the sample size needs to be bigger.
Yep.
And so the money needs to support it. And all of these things, I know it's not wasted on most people, but some people are, it's very easy to criticize research. There's no question about it. The hardest part, I think, and my skin's grown fairly thick over the years, is when somebody just says, oh, well, you should have done this. And I'm like, we know we should have done that.
Right.
But, to jump from this to this and miss then doesn't serve anybody, because if you get this, the wrong answer up at the high level, then everything's messed up, because then that translates back down. Everybody says, see. So you have to get the design right. And with people, because of this response variation that we see, you just need a lot of people. And as I said, the difference in variability between my two legs and within me is a lot less than between me and you.
Yep.
So we start out that way and we build the story.
And so I like that. I've come to like that design, because the people who argue about the crossover effect, well, it works both ways. So the whatever crosses over in this leg to this leg is going to be, so they should balance each other out. And like you said, I would love to, it's great to use yourself as the control, because you minimize that inter-individual response effect we talked about earlier. We have this huge variation. So, and then the other criticism I'll hear is that you're not using advanced subjects, but we'd all like to use advanced bodybuilders in our research, but A, that's hard to come by, and B, it's hard to get a bodybuilder who's going to be okay with just training one leg or sticking to some protocol. They have their set ways. And C, I'd argue that you also you need to start off, like what you're saying, you need to build the foundation. You need to start off with the general public. You don't jump right to the advanced bodybuilders, but I think you guys have included some advanced subjects in your routines, and they're seeing the same results, correct?
Yeah, and again, we're moving in that direction. And as I said, you know, if this is the population, now we're getting down and we're getting into the smaller and smaller sort of percentage of people. And if we're talking about the really big guys now, as you point out, if I come in, I'm going to say, okay, you're going to train this leg this way and this leg this way. They just look at me like, you know, man, you're crazy. I'm not, you know, why would I stop doing what I'm doing? You know, this means too much to me. So, you know, they're hard to convince. We have had some guys that are more trained than other, and we're moving into an area now where I think we're, I don't know if we're down in the tail, but we're definitely beyond the mean response. And so most of the people that we've recruited into this study that we have going on right now are more trained. And I think people need to look around themselves a little bit and realize is that the people that, as you point out, are the bigger guys in the gym that they always want to get the advice from because they're big. You have to ask yourself, is it because of what they do or in spite of what they do? Because, you know, some of these guys, like it doesn't appear, they do a minimal amount of work by comparison to, you know, where I am right now, I had to work my ass off to do it. And they just get it like that. And so
yep.
It's come a lot easier to them than it probably has to most people, I would guess.
And my experience is that you just have to work with a lot of people. Like you have done research on so many people by now that you've seen all the variations in response. But if you're just a guy who lifts yourself and then something works for you, you're going to just, oh, this is the end all be all. You need to do this program because I got huge right. from it or I got strong from it. But you don't know that this person, you know, you've never trained enough people to know that not every exercise works really well for every body type. Not every method works well for every person, and so the more people you train, the more you learn how to adapt programs to suit the individual's goals, body type, and logistics. Moving on, because I know you got to get going, and I have a couple more questions I want to ask. I want to sure. get into two more areas, protein intake and supplements, because I share a similar outlook on you on this matter. But real quick, I want to talk to, because you're one of the few labs who have actually looked at sarcoplasmic versus myofibrillar hypertrophy, and I wanted to discuss this kind of misconception out there, because a lot of times people think that if you do lightweights for high reps, you're just building fluid. You're just growing through fluid increase, and it's not functional. And if you do heavyweights, you know, sets of five, you're building density, you're building the myofibers, you know, you're sure. building the sarcomeres. And so there's been this whole there's so many articles I've seen over the last 5 years talking about how heavyweights is functional because you're building the sarcomeres and the myofibrillar hypertrophy, and then lightweights is not functional and you're just building sarcoplasmic hypertrophy, just the fluid and the like organelles within the fiber. And this is not a proper outlook. You do have, there's a little bit of truth to that maybe, but it's what
sure.
just by a minor percentage. Like if you do sets of 20 versus sets of 5, how much of a difference is a shift are you going to get in the types of hypertrophy?
So, you know, 60%+ of what's inside a muscle fiber are myofibrils, and they're packed very densely, and it's hard to fit a lot of other things in. So, you know, plus or minus, I'd say about 5%, that's the sort of variability you have. But this concept that you get sarcoplasmic versus myofibrillar or non-myofibrillar hypertrophy is absolutely incorrect. There's no way to hypertrophy and expand organelles and fluid within a muscle fiber that would fill up enough space to make it grow as big as the fiber that grew in the heavy group. I think the misconception is that you can talk about people maybe, you know, put a tape measure around one bicep one time and said, oh, well, it grew as much as the other one, but I'm not as strong, so it must be, you know, hypertrophy of something that's not force generating. That's not true. The reason you don't get as strong is because the neuromuscular connection between this and the low weight
yep.
or, you know, high repetition arm just isn't as good. So, you know, we know that strength is for a large part neuromuscularly driven. So, you know, this begins to talk to this and it talks to it more efficiently. You don't get as much activation of the co-activated muscle, antagonistic muscle. And so you get stronger. Whereas in this arm, you haven't been doing these strong maneuvers. Still get the hypertrophy, and so somebody's come up with this, well, it's sarcoplasmic versus myofibrillar, and that's, you know, and not to disparage people's lines of research, but there's just no evidence for that. So, you know, in our hands and in a lot of other labs, if you look at the percentage of a fiber that is myofibrillar protein, it's 60% plus or minus, I'd say about 5%. So yeah, in endurance athletes, there's a lot more mitochondria in there, but this is not what we're talking about when we're talking about, you know, something that's done 30 reps. That's not endurance exercise. It's an endurance-like exercise versus, you know, 4 to 5 reps. But there's just, it's time to sort of put, that's a hard one to put to bed, other than to just say, well, we just measure the protein contents and here's what it is. It's very simple to do, but if that's what it takes to put that one to bed, it just sort of seems to me as another one of these things. As a biochemist, I look at the fibers and I'm like, how could anybody think that that's right? But there you go.
Yep. Okay. All right. Two quick questions and I will let you get going. The first pertains to protein intake. This is debated a lot, and it's something that, you know, I think is skewed by the bodybuilders who are taking lots of steroids, anabolic steroids. But because you'll see bodybuilders who are taking in 400 grams of protein a day.
Sure.
But for guys that are natural, for guys like you and me and our most of our listeners and men and women, is what is the optimal amount? And, well, first let's talk about that.
Yeah. It's really hard to peg it. We have a paper that's going to come out hopefully really soon. The reviewers have had a good go at us. So it's about 0.25 grams of protein per kilo will maximally stimulate muscle protein synthesis after a workout. And so we're thinking that that's the sort of per meal dose that you might like to hit. And you can probably do it about 4 or 5 times a day. If you do the math and you sort of figure everything out, the calculation that I put out, and just as a sort of a ballpark, is somewhere around 1.8 grams of protein per kilogram per day tends to hit this sweet spot where, you know, you're going to maximize muscle growth, we think. And beyond that, and I'm not saying don't eat more protein because you got to put something into the machine, but we just don't think that it's contributing to muscular growth. Now, you want to eat twice that much, and you feel that's what you got to do, like I said, I'm not going to argue because, you know, the evidence is not great. But based on what we understand about how muscle responds, there's only so many times you can feed it, if you like, muscle in a day, and it'll take those amino acids on board, put them in a protein, and hang on to them. After that, it actually begins to turn off, if you like, and become non-responsive. And that's a classic, you know, biological feedback loop system. And not to say that the bodybuilders who, you know, take 4 grams, you know, they're bigger, but it's not because of the protein that they do it. You know, if they're lifting heavy and they're in the gym a lot, and if they are on steroids, then that's driving the bus. And you know, they could probably get away with a lot less protein and still be as big as they are. But you got to make a choice about what you're going to eat. And I don't necessarily think that eating more protein is a bad thing. So that's sort of where we stand on that.
So this, if you were, because you're talking in kilograms, because in Canada and the UK, you guys are logical and use the metric system. But, well, actually, UK doesn't. So,
we're still, when they talk stones over here, I don't even know what that is.
So in the U.S., we go by pounds. So this comes to not quite 1 gram per, because I always just tell people, because it makes it so easy, 1 gram per pound of body weight. I've said that for 10 years as a trainer, and it's a basic rule of thumb. Could you get the same doing less? Probably.
I still come back to this sort of continuum, and I think, you know, if you're the responder, I think you certainly do it with less. If you're this sort of hard gainer, then I think you can push a little bit more into the system and a little bit more total energy into the system and move yourself up the ladder. You're never going to be that guy at the other end, but I think you can do it. A gram a pound is—I don't have an issue with that. And, you know, that's 2.2 grams per kilo, and you know that's in the ballpark of, you know, some of the papers we've read.
And you're saying 1.8 is sufficient upper end.
You know, and again,
and what about the lower end?
Soft number, right? Mm-hmm. So I'd say, you know, most of the recommendations we've said, you know, anywhere from say 1.6 to 2.2 grams per kilo. So that's a little bit less than 1 gram to about 1 gram per pound, and beyond that, you can eat it, your body can, you know, digest it and everything. I just don't think your body can physically put it into muscle at a rate fast enough for it not to be used for other things. And at some point, you tear the nitrogen off a protein, and then you got to pee it out. And that's what, you know, humans, mammals, and birds, and lizards, everybody does that, because nitrogen it's toxic fundamentally. So, you know, so long as we appreciate that from a biological standpoint, and that's sort of where I kind of end and say, well, you know, you do what you got to do, but here's my recommendation to you.
So as a guy who read, you know, I spend more of my time reading biomechanics research. We all have our areas that we like more. And then you tend to find people you trust in the field, because I never fully confident with my opinion unless I've read all the papers. So I can tell, I know what Alan Aragon thinks on this topic. I know what you think. I know what Brad thinks. I like to listen to, I have a friend, Menno Henselman, who's smart on this. He goes by the lower end, and he's read all the papers, and he can critique the papers, and he'll say there's no evidence showing that above, and he likes the lower end. I know Eric Helms did a review paper.
Yeah.
I believe he has some an actual experimental paper coming out, but again, it's there's a lot of ways to do it, but from Alan Aragon and Brad's stuff, I'm kind of leaning towards you don't have to eat 8 times a day like we used to think. No. But I do think there's a sweet spot where you're not going to get maximum anabolism from eating 1 time a day. You need a certain amount of leucine signaling, so probably 3 times a day, I would think, would be the minimum. And then
we say 3 to 5.
3 to 5, but that's what most people do anyway.
Sure.
If you like eating twice a day, you probably aren't going to get your maximum response. Because you're going to have to eat. You know, if you're a 200-pound guy, you're going to have to eat a lot of protein in one sitting. You're not going to get as much of the leucine trigger. So is it better to eat more frequently? Maybe, but the point of Brad and Alan's stuff is it's not as important as people think it is. Like, it wasn't like, you know, back in the day, we talk about myths and misconceptions. I remember from the Body for Life book, I thought I had to be eating 8 times a day or I was going to go catabolic. And I remember right before I'd go to sleep, I'd be full, but I'd slug down a protein shake. I remember at one point in my life, in my mid-20s, I'd wake up in the middle of the night to go use the restroom, and I'd slam a protein shake. And that's probably going overboard, you know? So,
yeah, for sure.
So around 1.8 grams per kilogram of body weight, that comes to less. That comes to probably, what, like 0.8 grams per pound of body weight. And
something
so if you
like
weigh
that,
200
yeah.
pounds and you have 160 grams per day, you're probably hitting your bases. If you get a little bit more, the benefits to having a little bit more protein are that, well, the thermic effect of protein is higher. The satiety effect is a little bit higher. So you might have a better physique because you burn off more and you're not as hungry. The drawbacks are that you might waste that protein, and that those you could be having carbs and fat, which could fuel your workouts better. The higher fat could benefit hormone production. The higher carbs could benefit fuel your workouts better.
Yeah.
But the higher carbs could also contribute to decreasing insulin sensitivity, and the higher fat could go towards blah, blah, blah. It all comes down to figuring out your optimal system. Everything's a give or take. You've got to experiment with calories and macronutrients, but you don't need to feel compelled to be eating so much darn protein that everyone's saying, you know, that we used to say. probably 1.8 grams per kilo is sufficient.
That's what I would think, yeah.
Yep. Okay, good. We're on the same page there. And then the last topic, and then I will let you get going, is supplements. You have done a ton of research on supplements. I get asked this question all the time. It's not that I'm anti-supplements. It's just that I think that people spend so much focus on supplements when they're not. Usually you look at their diets and they're not eating. To me, the drawbacks of spending your money on all these supplements is that you could be getting more high-quality foods. You could be going to the store and buying, you know, because me, like, I sit there and God, I wish I was a celebrity, a millionaire. I'd have a chef and I'd be eating this every day.
Yeah.
I love ahi tuna. I love filet mignon. I love, you know, the nicer. And it's like, well, if you aren't buying your supplements, so much supplements, you could be eating that and enjoying your meals more.
Yeah.
What supplements have, and I know we can cherry pick studies and find evidence for every supplement working, but what supplements out there have a ton of evidence showing that they are very effective for muscle hypertrophy and decreasing body fat?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's really, when you build the hierarchy and you look at the evidence, and, you know, we've reviewed a lot of this stuff, obviously protein.
But protein, only if you're not, you can get the protein in your foods.
Sure.
Because I like taking whey. I like my whey protein. Do you take, like, whey supplementation?
Yeah, I do. I do whey with my breakfast meal, and I'm usually, I work out first thing in the morning. I'm usually fasted, and then I have my breakfast. So that's, you know, my breakfast is big. So at that time, you know, I think it's worth it. And I get a big satiety response and, you know, I feel really full. And it's, you know, for me, that's how I start my day. You're talking about creatine. I'd sort of give that an A grade. And then after that, things tend to drop off fairly rapidly. There's a little bit of excitement about HMB. I'm not overly convinced with that as a supplement.
Well, the HMB this is coming out of Wilson, Dr. Jacob Wilson's lab, and there's only one study so far, right? With the HMB,
the
free acid, which this is interesting. I always, when there's a new study, I chalk it up as interesting, but we need to learn more.
Right. And so, you know, the way I view supplements is if you're building the pyramid and the peak is, you know, whatever it is, physique or performance or whatever, the supplement is kind of the cherry on the top. And so the base is still get to training, good diet, good sleep, etc. And, you know, obviously the foundation would be genetics, I suppose.
Yeah.
And then right at the very top is, you know, there's a little bit of icing and a cherry, and that's where the supplements sit. I don't think that they're the difference between, you know, this guy down here and this guy up here. I believe they would take sort of everybody and probably shift them a little bit. But, you know, relative to the, you know, getting your training in and making sure you're training, and I always emphasize this to young athletes and say, is no supplement can make up for a poor or a missed workout. So, you know.
Yep. So you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, they're really, you don't need any supplements. There's nothing that's mandatory for you to see. You can add in creatine. Protein is good. I love my protein. But if you're getting your protein through beef and chicken and milk and whatever, you don't need the whey protein supplement. You want to get your protein. If you can get that through foods, great. If you're like me and you, you like a morning shake or a post-workout shake or a shake before you go to sleep, that's perfectly fine. Go for it, because I have trouble getting in all the protein through regular food per day.
Yeah.
But it's not mandatory if you can get it through food. Creatine can help. Creatine can help a couple percentage points, but it's not going to make this huge difference. And after that, you know, maybe HMB is interesting.
Yeah.
Fish oil is, there's lots of research on fish oil being healthy for you, but you can get that through eating fish. I don't really recommend anything else because, again, it takes the emphasis off of hard training and sleep. If people just took sleep more important and stress and focused on their diet and focused on their training, they'd see good results. But people want, you know, they want a panacea. They want this magic pill.
Yeah.
And it all comes down to genetics lay the foundation. Then you've got kind of the training and the dieting are equally as important, and then the very top of the pyramid is supplementation. And there's not, you know, the supplements do work, but it's not the huge effects that people think it is. It's the 1%, the 2%. So make sure you're doing everything else right.
Yep.
Okay, Stu, this was great. I appreciate your time. Hope to have you on in the future. And I should have reached out to you long ago, but it's good to get you on now. Thank you very much. I'm sure my readers will like listening to this.
I hope they do. It was my pleasure being with you, Brett. Thanks very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.